Coming to Sri Aurobindo Bhavan, is, as is said, both agony and ecstasy. Because Vishwajit believes Calcutta is West Bengal and West Bengal is Calcutta. So he gives me a good darshan of West Bengal before I come to the Bhavan. So I do go out into the districts, smaller towns, other centers, and it is so nice to see the work of Mother and Sri Aurobindo, how well it is proceeding in quite many remote nooks of West Bengal. And today, this is my kind of last talk in this trip of mine. But I was wanting to have this talk upstairs on the second floor, because I knew that this is a working day and I was not expecting many people to attend. But then on seeing the audience, I remembered a small experience of mine when I was in Japan some years back. You must have seen the Japanese paintings. I mean, there is just one little bamboo shoot and little small man meditating under the bamboo tree or the vast mountain. 88% or 85% is all emptiness. So I asked the Japanese, why do you keep that empty? In fact, the person explained that the attempt of the artist is to create that emptiness, to give you that feeling of that emptiness which is infinity. And man is a little mortal somewhere in the shadow of the infinite. So we don't want to give you a picture of the bamboo or the flower. We want to create this impression of the infinite. So he said, that's our attempt. And later on, when I was in Pondicherry, somebody, it seems, took a painting to the mother. And the mother made the same comment, saying that, why have you filled up this painting with so many figures? There should be space. There should be a lot of space. It's that empty space that should carry the figure in it. So the meaning of the finite comes out because of the infinite at the background. And so now I appreciate the emptiness in this hall, and I think that's a good way of doing it. But somebody asked me, quite surprisingly, about the title of the talk today. He said, double evolution of man? There's quite a note of surprise. And yes, in fact, that is the essential idea of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. Normally we think that we have been told, we have talked much about evolution and involution, and we have repeated quite parrot-like, saying that there is first an involution, the descent of consciousness, the devolution of consciousness, the Sachidananda comes through the different grades, etc., etc. And then there is the descent into the inconscient, and from the inconscient begins the evolution. We have spoken about that, and I think more or less we understand that. But if we just speak about the single involution and evolution, we do miss out one of the primary thoughts of Sri Aurobindo. It's true, in the beginning, there is this evolution from matter to life, life to mind, etc. And we have also said that there is this evolution, behind this evolution there is this sacred energy, what you call the force. And it is from matter there is this force which is evolving, which pushes itself up. And then you have the life, and then you have the, you know, the plant life, the animal life, etc. And millions of years pass, and then we have man, and then man proceeds. This is quite a straightforward idea which we have been reading. But what Sri Aurobindo would insist upon is that this is only the outer evolution. The evolution of the form, the evolution of body. But what truly evolves is the consciousness. It's because of the evolution of consciousness that the body responds to the need of the consciousness. So we have to understand it in this line. Otherwise we would be sticking only to the evolutionary theory as given by the scientists. And the scientist only sees the outer form. We have Darwin's theory and hundreds of other theories, but all of them have looked upon evolution as evolution of form. Well, so there is simultaneously the form, but basically and essentially it is the consciousness. And remember the single formula, that consciousness and force, chit, tapas, they are inseparable. So wherever you see force, there is bound to be consciousness. That's why it comes to very easy conclusion when we say what the scientists have told us today, the theory of matter, that matter is ultimately energy. We know the famous equation. But that matter is energy, and energy is inseparable from consciousness. So it's very easy for the philosophers and the metaphysicians to say, well, energy is consciousness. Because we have the question of chit tapas, consciousness force. So once we know this basis, then what the scientist tells us is already the same truth as the truth of the philosophy. But he doesn't yet know the word consciousness. But he has come to the last step which science could have revealed to us, that matter is essentially energy. But that is one line. And the basic thing we understand now is the evolution of consciousness. Well, that is, all this is prior to the coming of man. But what we are interested today is to see the double evolution of man. And now what could be the double evolution of man or in man? Well, basically it's the same thing. One is the evolution of the outer, the other the evolution of the inner. Now this is, in fact, when you come to the end of Life Divine, to the last 4 or 5 chapters of Life Divine. In fact, the last 6 chapters, which are supposed to be the essence of the Life Divine. Essence in the sense, Sri Aurobindo brings out his own original ideas there. Prior to those last 6 chapters, there is a kind of Sri Aurobindo reviewing the old theories of philosophy in East and West. Of course, in the first section, there is the thought of supermind and overmind, the triple aspect of supermind. Some of these are originally Sri Aurobindo's, but basically in part 2, We see a lot of the revision of what is ignorance, the sevenfold ignorance, what is illusion, what is error, etc. So when we come to the last six chapters of the Life Divine, there he kind of brings in the whole synthesis. And it is there we get this idea that there is this outer evolution of man which uses the physical heredity as the basic principle. So we zoom down to two words, that there is an outer evolution based on the principle of heredity. And that is what has carried man from those caves, the man of the caves, to the present man of the computer. It is basically the question of heredity in the genes. Now we have the biology telling us. It's the genes which carry the characteristics of the previous race. So the evolution has been very gradual, but very constant. And not only biologically is there this question of heredity and then there is an evolution, but at the same time, this heredity is there the outer evolution is there on the level of the outer cultural manifestations. What the Greeks had told us, what the Vedas had told us, it is that is being passed on to the present times. So what a few people have discovered, both in spirituality or in science or technology or history or science, wherever it is, that is being passed on from generation to generation. So what happens is today, if we are computer age or a knowledge age, it's because yesterday somebody did something on a scientific level. Because before that somebody discovered the wheel. Because something has happened. So there is a continuity of evolution on the outer level. And what is the aim of the individual in the outer level? That if I am a businessman, if I am a scientist, if I am a philosopher or a man of literature, I do my best, I write my poetry and philosophy and science and all that, I pass it on to the next generation. So my aim in life becomes that I do my best. In the process I earn my living, I do earn my comfort, I do earn my money, etc. But at the end of the day, I leave behind something for the next generation to pass on. So there is a progress, there is an evolution of the outer. That is fine. I mean, you read any cultural history, you understand that every great person, Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo or Kalidas or anybody, they have passed on. But then the basic question is, what happens in this outer evolution? Outer evolution is meant for the collective evolution of man. So the word that we can equate is outer evolution, or the evolution of form, or the evolution that is based on essentially physical heredity, is meant for the collective growth of mankind. But then Sri Aurobindo asks the question, what happens to the individual? You see, in the Western thinking, this is good enough, that you do your best and you die and you pass on your things to the next generation and finish. But in the Eastern world, we are not only bothered about the outer evolution or the collective evolution. On the contrary, we could even say to the extent that we are not even bothered at all about the collective evolution. We have taken a completely different angle. Eastern philosophies have looked upon the question of the individual's evolution or the individual evolution. So then there is a major distinction. One is the collective evolution, the other is the evolution of the individual. And this is where philosophically, from the point of view of spirituality, from the point of view of a kind of an inner seeking, that is the basic difference when we say East and West. It's not a geographical difference, which is nowadays melting down, as we can see. But in spite of the melting down of the Eastern and Western borders, psychologically, philosophically, there is still this major divergence of view. Sri Aurobindo calls that there is no difference between East and West. Basically, both are moving toward the same evolutionary end. But surely there is a divergence of view. From which angle are you approaching that end? One approach is from the collectivity, the other one from the individual. So there is this question of the evolution of the individual, and the basis of this evolution of the individual is rebirth. So we come down to two words, heredity and rebirth. So rebirth looks into the evolution of your soul. Heredity looks into the evolution of your body. And these are the two evolutions that are going on parallelly. It could be, we can say really parallelly, of course it's not necessary they're exactly parallel, one could be a little behind the other. But these are the two ways or the directions of evolution. Now this question of rebirth, many philosophies or many cultures or even religions don't even agree upon this. Why should we think of rebirth? And Sri Aurobindo would precisely say, well, rebirth, you don't have to think about it. As a principle of philosophy, you don't have to have it. You can very well do without it. But if you think that there is any kind of a spiritual goal of the destiny of man, then rebirth becomes inevitable and indispensable, philosophically. You cannot think of the growth of the individual without thinking of the process of rebirth. Because it is the individual psychic being, the soul that normally we say, it is the individual psychic being that goes from birth to birth changing form. But how does it change form? What form does it take upon itself in the next birth? Well, again, there are theories and theories. There is also the angle of the Gita where it says that whatever you think of in your last minute before you die, so that you become in your next life. There are also views that before you die, if you formulate what you want to become next life, you can become that. There are many things. But the basic thing is that what is the purpose of the soul taking a new body? Well, in India, we have always believed on the theory of karma, that whatever I have accrued in this life, the negative and the positive, the credit and the debit, that is passed on to the next life. And I take a next life so that I can fulfill my karma, I can erase my bad karma, I can add to my good karma. But Sri Aurobindo would say that is very childish, if you can think in that manner, that the soul comes only to work out the karma of the past life. That is almost a kindergarten thought. The deeper thing is that it wants to gain a new experience. And in that new experience, it wants to have an experience that it did not have in the previous life. Because you must remember, the soul is constantly, the psychic being is constantly growing by adding to itself new experience. Just as we in our own life, we say he is a man with great experience. So we value a person who has a lot of experience. That means there is a great kind of maturity. So the soul also is trying to gain this kind of a maturity, and this, for this, it acts a new experience in each life. And for this new experience, it brings with it the necessary instrumentation. That's what we should remember. That is not that it just comes in bringing in any kind of mind, body and life. If it wants to be a philosopher, if it wants to be an artist, if it wants to be a businessman, the instrumentation of the mind and the vital and the physical are brought in as a package. Shobhinda in fact uses this word package. It comes with its own package. And one ingredient of this package, that's the great, the mysterious point, is that it brings the subtle mind, the subtle physical, the subtle vital. Now what is this subtle vital, etc.? This is where our Indian thought of the karma and Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, they join. Because one question we always have, that if the soul really leaves behind this body and goes away to its own loka, the psychic world or Ananda loka or whatever you call it, then what is the fun of all this question of, you know, bad karma and good karma? How does this karma go along with the soul? Because we have been told by Sri Aurobindo and the mother that the soul leaves behind the physical, then it leaves behind the vital sheath after some days or months or years, depending upon our attachment. Because, you see, this is where again I see so much that the life and death are a single journey. Normally we think we are here and after death that is different and this is different. Except for the element of the physical body which is left upon earth, the soul has the same sheath behind it. The vital sheath goes with the soul. And the mental sheath, Manomaya Purusha, also goes with that. So what happens? The soul carries with it the vital sheath for a number of months or years, depending on how much attachment we had while we were in the body. And that is where Sri Krishna's great message, that work with detachment. So detachment is necessary not only while we are in the body, but if we have some kind of a detachment here, then our vital sheath does not stick to the body, to the soul, for long many years. And so the soul can relieve itself of all these attachments, of this vital sheath of desires, and then go away only with the mental sheath. And there also it takes some time. All our ambitions, mental desires, mental prosperity, mental attachments, all this have to be dissolved in the mental world. It's only then that the soul can go to its Ananda Loka. In fact, I've been reading so recently some of these last chapters of the Life Divine. It is, you know, we hadn't come across these thoughts in the beginning of the chapters of the Life Divine. Because he would tell us here that not every soul goes to the Ananda Loka. Because if we are too much attached to the physical, then it may be that the soul comes back right from the subtle physical back to birth. If we have too much attachment with the vital needs and the vital things about food and shelter and all that, then unfortunately our soul will not be able to move on. It returns from the vital world itself. And do we want that our soul does not take shelter or rest in its Ananda Loka, where it can gather its energies, where it can really decide positively for its next life? Unfortunately, it is very few souls who can return to this Ananda Loka. Otherwise, depending on the consciousness we live here in the body, the soul also goes to that level and returns. So this has been quite a shocking thing for me, because up until now, until I read this Life Divine chapters, I was imagining, or I was under the impression, that after a certain time, the soul does go to its Ananda Loka. But this is a little detail that Sri Aurobindo gives us, but it's quite a shocking detail. However, to trace our own story of the journey, then once it goes up, then our question was, all the karma that we have, the good and the bad, so where is the carrier? Who is the carrier of this karma? Because the soul ultimately goes away. Then where this karma, where is it stocked or piled up or put into these cubicles, so that when my soul comes back, my karma comes back. And Sri Aurobindo and the mother clarify that the karma is loaded into your subtle physical, subtle mind, subtle vital. So it is this inner subliminal which is left behind in the subliminal world, and the psychic being on its journey backward or returning upon earth, it takes up that baggage. So the subliminal in us continues to be more or less the same. And it is that which is the carrier of our karma. So this is now where I see the old yoga and Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, they kind of join, they gel. So that is why the theory of karma is true, and it has its validity. And at the same time, what Sri Aurobindo is explaining, that the soul comes for a new experience, brings back the subliminal, and brings new capacities of the mind. And why does it do that? Because it wants to have a new experience. And this new experience is for its own growth. Now, when we use the word growth, we understand by it, it is more a question of not only a physical growth, but also a growth of experience. And I use the word physical growth. That's again something marvelously well explained by the mother. That the psychic being, which is supposed to be Angushta Matre, according to the Upanishads, the psychic being which is as big as the thumb, it grows in its size with each experience. And that's what we call the growth of the psychic being. There's a physical growth. And I find this remarkable, especially in the light of what Sri Aurobindo and the mother explained about the transformation of the body. Because this has also been my question. The what do we understand by the transformed body? What Sri Aurobindo calls the supramentalized body. How does that come about? Have we ever asked that question? Maybe philosophically, it may be irrelevant for many of us, it's not so much so on the horizon of tomorrow. But if this is the thought given to us by Sri Aurobindo, we must understand. When it happens, it's not our business. It may happen whenever it wants to be. But at least mentally, do we have a clarity of the transformation of the body? And this is where the mother explains that this, that when we speak of the immortal body, then the simple thing is, this body itself, the physical, the bones and the flesh and the skin and all that, that is not immortal. Our mind and desires and vital, that is not immortal. What is immortal in us? The soul, the psychic being. So she says it is the psychic being which will materialize itself as a new body. I mean, I'm throwing out some ideas which could be quite in the thin air. But as I'm trying to go through the same whole theory, let me complete the story. So she says, it is the immortal within us which will substantiate itself and become the body. That will be the supramental body. In fact, in the 71 or 72, in her notes on the way, she does see this. In fact, if I remember it rightly, she was asking this question to Sri Aurobindo, that how will it happen, this new body? On one side, she is struggling with her own transformation of the body. She is trying to really take out each cell and put into that supramental consciousness, to drill into it the supramental consciousness, so the cells from the mortal body can be transformed into the immortal. But then there is the other process. She says the psychic being also, it becomes so big. In fact, there was one person who came to her during the darshan or private darshan, whatever. And she sees that person suddenly so big in the psychic being. She says almost 6 to 8 inches outside of her physical body. I mean, that is something incredible, to think that a psychic being is outside the body. We thought it just one angusha matra within inside the body. But she says, I've seen the psychic being outside the physical body of the person. And suddenly the thing clicks in her mind. She realizes this will be the future new body. And so her question is answered, how will there be a new immortal body? And then she says, it is the psychic being, the immortal in the mortal, which will become immortal tomorrow. And I related this story because now we understand the meaning of the growth of the psychic being. Why is the psychic being growing? Why is this inner evolution more important than the outer evolution? Outer evolution, we may have all the scientific things, we may go to moon, we may have our holidays there. It seems from the next couple of years, people can go on a picnic holiday trip to summer vacation to moon also. We can do all that and all that. But it has no relevance for the new race of tomorrow. Because the new race of tomorrow will be born not of our inner evolution, not the evolution of the psychic being. So this is where we see the outer evolution, which is selective, and the inner evolution, which is individual. Not only are they going parallel, but it is always the individual who must lead the collective. So Mother and Sri Aurobindo have emphasized upon this integral yoga, wherein each one of us is concerned with the growth of the psychic being. Because collectively we want it or not, things will happen. You see, we were supposed to be Sri Aurobindo ashram, quite cut off from the world. We didn't want to bother about the science and all that. But today, all the departments in the ashram, all the departments in the centers, everyone, we have computers. All of us use mobiles. We have all used SMSs. We didn't work for it. We didn't want it. But the collective growth of man impinges upon us. We grow. But the individual growth, we have to do it ourselves. So Sri Aurobindo is telling us, follow the psychic. Try to grow for the individual psychic being. Because it's these individuals with the psychic being who will guide, mastermind, spearhead the evolution. Otherwise we'll remain for long many years, decades, on this collective evolution, being more comfortable to more comfortable to ultimately so much comfortable that we may be, as Sri Aurobindo describes one someplace, that mankind may commit suicide under the weight of its own scientific discoveries. Science may be so big, our technology may be so heavy, that one day it may crumble on us and we will be destroyed. So he says the inner evolution is what is important. Now, there is another angle that Sri Aurobindo brings in because of this double evolution. So this is one way of looking at the double evolution, the collective, the individual, the outer, the inner, inheritance and rebirth. These are the key words that I am giving you. Then there is the other evolution on the outer itself. We have said outer is collective effort. But in this collective effort also, nature has given to mankind 4 steps. Aurobindo describes in the Life Divine. There are 4 stages of evolution through which mankind is led by nature towards his own individual highest evolutionary process. He would say, there is the evolution of the mind, and then there is the evolution of the inner being or the spiritual being. Well, we have already seen the inner being or the spiritual being, but that is the climax. But there is this evolution of the mind, he would say. Because it's not, normally we think, some of these old yogas have told us that what is the meaning of this existence? It has no other aim but to quit the world. We are here in ignorance, in maya, suffering and pain and sorrow, leave this world and get back to that origin. But Aurobindo would tell us that this, if this is the intention, then the mental evolution has no purpose. Well, then the question is, has there been any mental evolution? Well, yes. And we will see what has been the mental evolution. But on the spiritual side also, man has always sought to escape. Till now, you ask a common Indian around any part of the world, part of India, each one of us think that escape is the best way. Otherwise, this world is too much with us. We are in too much of ignorance and terror and violence. You look around the world today, there's hardly a day when there is no bomb blast anywhere in some part of the world. So we really become pessimistic, and then we say, well, this world is a dog's tail. It will never mend itself. It's better we escape. So what Aurobindo would tell us is this escapism of the ascetic is also there because, you know, there is an intensity. He would not really reject the ascetic in a summary manner. He says the ascetic is also having a tremendous pain, that this world is too full of pain, and the other side he has a tremendous pang for the divine. That is the source of real true ascetics. It's not that they escape this world. It begins with that escapism of the sorrow and suffering. But somewhere deep within is a call for the beyond. And for that call for the beyond, the person wants to escape and reach the supreme consciousness. But then he says that is one trend which we cannot deny. But there is this other trend wherein he says that there is a push towards the extension of spirituality in all the parts. This is where Sri Aurobindo has come in. Till now, the evolution of mankind, in the evolution of humankind, there has been this escapism toward the spirit. But now with the coming of Sri Aurobindo, the whole trend has changed. Now it is spiritualizing the whole of the human personality. So you see, there is a terrific change in the tide of spirituality. So this is what Sri Aurobindo has taken up, spiritualizing the whole of the human personality. But before we come to this last portion of Sri Aurobindo spiritualizing the human personality, what do we see? What we said about the steps in the mental evolution. And this is where he says, there have been 4 main lines in the human evolution. And you will see something very interesting that he speaks here. He says, first of all, there has been religion. which has been there since the beginning of man's evolution. Then the other one is occultism. Third one is spiritual philosophy. And the fourth one is spiritual experience. Well, here you do not see any mention of economics, business, management, technology. Not that in his time they were not there. But then he has chosen, these are the four main steps of the evolution of the mind, of the human mind, towards becoming a spiritual mind. Or we can say, stages between mind turning to spirituality. That is religion, occultism, spiritual philosophy, and spiritual experience. So when I read this, you know, I was really taken aback that what is the position of all this so much hullabaloo about this business and science and technology? Hasn't this added to any kind of human progress in the human mind? Is it something negative? So I have to think over that, and we'll see what we can really discover about this so-called huge, you know, you've got theories of management. There's such a big madness about management everywhere. But why hasn't Sri Aurobindo mentioned a word about this economic world, economics of the world, etc.? Well, I'll trace it perhaps when we come to the point. Now he would say that these four main lines of evolution are not really one after the other. They could be there simultaneously, but this has been kind of the natural growth of man. What is it? You see, we have in our primary prehistoric days, when the people were there in the caves, looking at the sun and the moon and the storms and the tempests and the violent winds, he says there must have been a thought that they are so powerful. You see, when the rainstorm comes, when the cyclone comes, it destroys everything. Even now we are terrified of a cyclone. So we can see this brute force. And so he says, even those cavemen, those early people, must have thought that there is some kind of a consciousness or a force behind all this sun and the moon and the wind and all that. So then they said, what is behind there? There must be some creator, some person, some consciousness, some force. Of course, these are philosophic terms. They didn't have all these philosophic terms. But the thought of the creator. And then they worshipped him and they wanted to know about him. And then they said, if I appease that creator, maybe my house will not be destroyed. So it is more for the self-protection that they wanted to appease these forces of nature. And that was the beginning of religion. So this appeasement. So he says it was natural in man. He didn't have to be told by anybody. It was very natural. So this natural tendency was what was later given the title of religion. And then at the same time, he says we must also go behind our own exterior. You see, very soon, simultaneously with the creator, the early man also started thinking of some evil forces. Good forces and evil forces. What we see, the black magic forces. I mean, that is why in the primitive religions, in primitive places, we still speak of these evil forces. And so he said, my God, these evil forces are there around, which are again harming us. So let us also know about them and try to appease them. And that wanting to know these invisible forces around, that was the beginning of what we say
occultism.
So you see, these are natural things. And this is how he has grown from religion and occultism. And at a point, religion and occultism, they join hands. So in every religion, there is occultism. And behind every occultism, there is a religious belief, a religious sanction. So that is how, for long many centuries, religion has had a grip over mankind because it used its occult principles of fear. So this occultism was given more as fear. Even today, we are afraid of these occult forces. We are afraid of these forces, what damage they will do to me. So religion has used occultism more or less for this purpose of grabbing the human consciousness and wanting to control it. And that has lasted till recent centuries when modern science came and blasted this entire concept. Now the third one is, he would say, the question of when the intellect began to be developed, say, if we always say with the Greeks, the mental consciousness started developing. In India, it's with the Buddha that the mental consciousness started developing. And when this mental consciousness started developing, then the mind became critical and analytical. It didn't want to believe in religion. It poo-pooed the occult. He said, no, let me take away the cobwebs of religion. Let me understand the principles rationally. So came in the rational understanding of religion, the rational understanding of the principles behind occultism. And this stage was in fact negative and positive in both ways. It was positive because it really took away a lot of these cobwebs, and we were in the dark ages, we were full of superstitions. Not that the superstition is not there in India or in Africa or in China or in Thailand. I've seen in Thailand superstitions are plenty, in India we are still so-called educated people, so-called with PhDs and in IAS and officers. We still are under the heavy garb of this superstition. So it lingers on. But this is where the Western contemporary mind has gotten rid of pretty much. They don't believe in the superstition. There are some pockets, definitely, I won't say no. But far and large, they are little liberated from these superstitious things, from these dark age beliefs. And so rationalism has helped in this manner, the West. And now there is a tendency that rationalism must be brought into India, and we analyze our own spirituality, our own religion in the light of this rationalistic approach. But Sri Aurobindo would tell us that this would be perhaps the danger that rationalism could bring in, because it takes away your faith. It takes away your bhakti. So it questions your faith and bhakti so much so that for spirituality it could become dangerous. To a point, as Sri Aurobindo says in many other instances, reason is the helper, reason is the bar. After a point, reason becomes the bar. So this is what is happening in the present times. The reason is overstepping itself and trying to grab spirituality and analyzing that. And that is where is the contemporary tendency. We have come across so many books from the West and especially from the USA analyzing, criticizing even Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramana, and all these great spiritual masters of India. They have been put under the scanner of rationalistic approach. And you see, this is where I would say reason overstepping itself. To a point it was good, but then when it crosses over a point, then it becomes dangerous. And that is the danger that Sri Aurobindo alludes to and tells us that this could be the downfall, and we should be aware of this rationalistic approach. Then the fourth one, as we said, he says none of this religion or occultism or rationalism have any value or validity until they become a part of your own spiritual experience. So that is the fourth, the highest step when spirituality comes in. So this is where Sri Aurobindo says the human mind has grown, has passed through several stages. And when we say the human mind, let us not imagine that the entire humanity has gone through this. It is always an elite, as Sri Aurobindo calls the avant-garde, the spearheading people. Maybe it's like, you know, the pyramid, the tip of the iceberg. 1/10 of humanity is on this level. 9/10 is still following its own religious, its own occult, its own rational approaches. But 1/10 has definitely reached the tip of the iceberg. 1/10 has definitely reached the spiritual experience. And that is what is valid. But in this process, there has been, how did the spiritual process begin, first of all? You see, religion, when we said religion really only points us towards the divine, it has followed two methods, Sri Aurobindo would say, the esoteric and the exoteric. Esoteric is the concentrated, dynamic and effective movement. That means few centers of spirituality, some ashrams, some centers, some individuals. These are the people who are dynamically related, connected to a spiritual experience, and they are living that experience. So that those people are moving towards spirituality. Such kind of individuals have been there throughout human history. You may take Kabir Das or Mirabai or somebody in India, we know so many names. These are the living examples of mystics and saints and rishis and yogis. But unfortunately, there is this exoteric movement. That means the movement towards diffusion. You see, Sri Aurobindo says this movement is dangerous and yet it is inevitable. For example, Swami Vivekananda, it seems he was at a point in a dilemma as to start the Sri Ramakrishna Math or not to start. He said, if I don't start the Sri Ramakrishna Math, then the truth that Sri Ramakrishna gave us may be lost. They'll be there in the books, some people will read, but it will not become a concrete force. But if I make a Sri Ramakrishna Math, then the truth itself will be diluted. The central experience of Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna, may be lost. But then he says, I have no choice. It's better to have a diluted truth than a truth that is lost. So he started all the Ramakrishna Maths that we had in the present world today. So this is the dilemma in front of every spiritual institution. We have the same thing happening in Sri Aurobindo. Do we have this esoteric or the exoteric? But all the centers that are growing up mushroom-like all over the country. Orissa, it seems, has 65 relic centers. Every state prides itself in the number of relic centers and in the number of centers itself. There is a tremendous boom of this exoteric movement. But obviously, as Sri Aurobindo says, in this diffusion, there is dilution. It is inevitable. But then he would tell us, this step had to be taken For the expansive movement was an inherent necessity of the spiritual urge in evolutionary nature. Sri Aurobindo would say, this is inevitable. Because if the movement had stopped at the Vedic times, we would have had only an X number of Vedic rishis. Today we wouldn't have known the Vedic truths at all. But there is a large difference between the Vedic rishis and us. And yet, the truths have come down to us. So says Sri Aurobindo would say, always in nature, the new movement begins with an individual or a group of people. Then it expands, it gets lost, and then there is a rebirth in another group of people. That is how it keeps on moving forward. So we see this movement everywhere. And Sri Aurobindo says, we can't avoid this. It has happened in occultism, it has happened in spirituality, it has happened in religion, and it will keep happening. But now what we are interested in seeing, that this question, when we come to the spiritual age. Now I gave you a question in between telling what is the role of this management and economics and all that that's happening now. You see, Sri Aurobindo speaks of the coming of the new spiritual age. And as you said, there is an elite of humanity that is consciously moving towards a spiritual age. And this movement is not recognized, or sometimes we come across many criticisms. You see, when we go abroad, we are faced with a lot of materialistic sciences and philosophies which really question us, saying that, do you think there is anything called spirituality at all? We see only in economic growth, political growth, institutional growth and all that. Where is spirituality? We see something of religion surely. The way religions and temples and churches are building and increasing every day. But is there anything called the spiritual? And the question is, why they don't want to recognize spirituality is a single question. What has spirituality done for humanity? This was the question. It was asked plenty of times to Sri Aurobindo Ashram also. Because any time we say this is spirituality, then they say, hey, what have we done for us? For us means for society, for community, for the country. That's the question. Is very difficult to answer. And I found an answer in Sri Aurobindo. He gives it a direct answer saying, in answer it can be said that this is not the standpoint from which the true significance of the spiritual evolution in man or the value of spirituality can be judged or assessed. For its real work is not to solve human problems on the past or present mental basis, but to create a new foundation of our being and our life and knowledge. That is a marvelous answer. It is not the business of spirituality to solve human problems, basing itself on past, present and mental basis. He says the business of spirituality is to create a new foundation of our being and our life and knowledge. And I found an excellent example of this in the Bhagavad Gita. You see, when Arjuna refuses to fight on the basis of morality, asceticism, sin and all those logics that he puts forth, Sri Krishna doesn't. First, Sri Krishna gives him lot of answers on his own level. First of all, he says, you are a kshatriya, you must be doing a duty of the kshatriya. Then he says, no, you are not supposed to think of all this. All kinds of, he arouses his sense of shame also, his sense of pride, his sense of duty. Nothing works. Arjuna is still arguing the questions. He is not convinced. Then what does Sri Krishna do? He gives Arjuna a new vision of life, a new vision of the understanding of the basics of life. So that's exactly what Sri Aurobindo is telling us, to create a new foundation of our being. So there Arjuna is told that you are not just the body, mind and life. You are an Atma. You are a soul. And then he gives Arjuna this totality of the human being. Not only the totality of what man is, a new vision of man, but a new vision of Godhead. God is not just Indra and Varuna to be appeased. He says, I am also Kala, the destroyer is me, the enjoyer is me. I am their whole thing. So essentially how Sri Krishna has convinced Arjuna? By giving him a new vision and understanding of man and life and God. That is what convinces him at the end, not all these questions of morality, etc. So Sri Aurobindo's answer, I found a brilliant example in the Gita. And then Sri Aurobindo goes further to say that the solution of the problem which spirituality offers is not a solution by external means, though these also have to be used, but by an inner change, a transformation of the consciousness and nature. And Sri Aurobindo tells us, the spirituality cannot be called upon to deal with life by a non-spiritual method or attempt to cure its ills by the pernicious, the political, social or other mechanical remedies which the mind is constantly attempting and which have always failed and will continue to fail to solve anything. You see, a wonderful answer. You see, why do you want spirituality to treat you the way a medical science is treating you? If the doctor is giving you a pill for your stomachache, fine, go to the doctor. Why should a yogi give you also a pill? Because on the physical level the doctor is there. On the mental level the psychologist is there. So other panaceas are there. For uplifting mankind we have had so many isms. Socialism, communism, this ism, that ism. We have employed all kinds of external things. But do you want spirituality also to give you one more ism? And when spirituality has seen that all these external things are a failure, all the isms are a failure, why should Sri Aurobindo come back to say, I will give you one more ism, do this and don't do that, wake up at 8 o'clock, do this. What's the fun? I will not repeat myself and go on the path which have been proved as failures. So Sri Aurobindo says, do not question spirituality on the parameters of the other panaceas. That's the basic message. What spirituality does, no other ism or solution can do. So do not equate. And he also would say that it is not a thing that will be brought into the laboratory, into the testing ground. And the moment you say this to the materialist, he says exactly, that is why I don't like spirituality, because spirituality is so very subjective. You say it is true for you, but it may not be true for me. So we say subjective things, we will not accept you. And the one more grudge that the materialist has against the spiritualist is, okay, some people have got released from this liberation, from this suffering, but look at science. How many hospitals it has built? How many medicines it has discovered? How much it has alleviated human suffering? And spirituality? 5, 10, 15, 5,000 people are only gotten, become sadhus and sannyasins, gotten to the mountains and freed themselves. So this is the main argument, that spirituality is individualistic and subjective. Science and materialism is collective and universal. So the first part we have seen Sri Aurobindo telling us, don't compare spirituality with others. And secondly, he would tell us, yes, up until now, spirituality has been basically individualistic. No doubt about it. And that is the reason why Sri Aurobindo is insisting upon the collective yoga. It's no more the time for individual yoga. If we want spirituality to really uplift humanity, it must be collective. And integral yoga cannot afford to be individualistic anymore. Otherwise, we'll also be clubbed into this old yoga. Do your Shastanga Pranam, do these things, get your mukti, get your realization, and you are over. So we cannot be that. And then, when we say, ours is not that kind of a spirituality, I will end with a marvelous quotation giving us what in Sri Aurobindo's concept is true spirituality. This I would ask all of you to read Life Divine, volume 19, page 857. It is SABCL, Sri Aurobindo's collected works and centenary works. Page 857. I mean, this is the most comprehensive definition of spirituality. And this is Sri Aurobindo. I read out the line. But the error, even the formations which are the first effects of the perception or urge or the first indices of a spiritual evolution, must inevitably be of this complete and tentative nature. Now begins the description. But the error so created comes very much in the way of a true understanding, and it must therefore be emphasized that spirituality is not a high intellectuality, not idealism, not an ethical turn of mind or moral purity and austerity, not religiosity or an ardent and exalted emotional fervor, not even a compound of all these excellent things, a mental belief, creed or faith, an emotional aspiration, a regulation of conduct according to a religious or ethical formula, are not spiritual achievement and experience. In the Vedic Upanishadic style, he has given us neti neti, what spirituality is not. I mean, with one stroke, he has taken away this entire present understanding or misunderstanding of spirituality. Because everyone thinks that it is a high ethical turn of mind, or a morality, or a moral purity and austerity. In India especially, he has taken to spirituality. Why? He has become from yesterday a vegetarian. He is sleeping on the ground. He is not smoking. He is doing all that. His moral purity, austerity, and all this. And then purity and austerity, not religiosity. You see, in our South India, we have a religion, 40 days of Lent period. You don't wear stitched clothes, you have lungi and bare body. You have to walk without slippers, you have to sleep on the ground. You are not allowed to use that, you are not allowed to eat that. All this religiosity. And then we think, I become a spiritual man. But what happens after the 40 days? 41st day you come back with a vengeance and maybe eat double chicken and double mutton and double biryani. You see, all this vitally suppressed. You have controlled the outer. And that's what Sri Aurobindo says, because we are not able to purify and control the inner, the vital, the desires, we easily extend it to the body and say, hey body, you're not supposed to take all this. No smoking, no this thing, no non-vegetarian, no this thing. So you say, well, you see, I've become such a spiritual man. And I'm telling you, I'm not exaggerating, because in Bangkok when I was there, one Thai lady comes to us and says, hey, Dr. Reddy, I'm spiritual from today. I said, my God, how come? Overnight you become spiritual? Because I left non-vegetarian. So you see, what a fallacy we have. All this external cutting off, which is so very easy. And then you cut off the external and then you claim to be spiritual. If the external could make you a spiritual, we would have all been saints and yogis and maybe on the corridor of supermind. But you know very well where we are. Million miles away from supermind. So what we want to say is nothing of the external purification adds to your spirituality. So he says, or an ardent and exhausted emotional fervor. All this bhakti, you know, we dance in the streets, bhakti, this, singing. This is all emotional fervor with band and music and tabla and dol. Nothing of the sort. Not even a compound of all these excellent things. A mental belief, creed or faith. I believe in this. I am an Aurobindonian. This is my faith. This is my creed. You may have only smelled what is spirituality, but not become spiritual. And I am telling this very purposely to be very honest with ourselves. We believe in Sri Aurobindo, but is that enough? So he says, belief, creed or faith, an emotional aspiration, a regulation of conduct according to a religious or ethical formula. Get up 8 o'clock in the morning, go to the samadhi, do this washing. A regulated activity, nothing. I mean, I must tell you, this has blasted my mind when I read all these things. Because we were so much into this kind of a notion of spirituality. And then he says, now the iti comes in so beautiful. This is a master sentence, I must tell you. These things are of considerable value to mind and life. Considerable value. They give you some kind of a psychological hook. Baba, I am ektukane spiritual, I am becoming a little better man. Eituku, nothing more than that. But at least it gives you some kind of a, you know, what we say, price of consolation price. This is a consolation price, nothing more than that. So he would say, these have a considerable value for to mind and life. They are of value to the spiritual evolution itself as preparatory movements, disciplining, purifying or giving a suitable form to the nature. So when we set the mind stages from religion to occultism to spiritual philosophy to spiritual experience, they prepare you. We are just learning the alphabets of spirituality by doing all this creed and faith and regulation and all that. And then he would say, but they still belong to the mental evolution. I mean, Sri Aurobindo does not mince words. All the highest achievement that we see in our country and the world, they are still part of the mental evolution only. The beginning of a spiritual realization, experience, change is not yet there. Now the positive side. Spirituality is in its essence an awakening to the inner reality of our being. The first step, what is spirituality? An awakening to the inner reality. The materialist will never believe that I have a soul, that there is a divine in me. Isha Vasyam Idam, that the divine pervades this entire world. Materialist doesn't even know that there is a divinity within us. So the first step, at least I think, we the Indians are ahead of the so-called westernized mind, because we at least believe that there is something within us. We call it Atma, we call it Atta, we call it soul, we call it psychic being, or we call the inner being, we call it the Chaitya Purusha, whatever. We know there is something inside. So that's the first thing. So, first is the awakening to the inner reality of a being, to a spirit, self, soul, which is other than our mind, life and body. And now, that's the first one. Second phase, an inner aspiration to know, to feel, to be that, to enter into contact with the greater reality beyond and pervading the universe which inhabits also our own being. What's the second state? An aspiration to know. You see how marvelous it is. All the stages of yoga are here. First you are aware that there is a different being. Second, you want to know him. You see, to give you a very mundane experience, a boy and a girl fall in love. They see each other that yes, she is there, he is there. But then you want to know about the other person. You start sending SMSs. You start sending messages, who are you? What can I know about you? So this is the knowledge of that inner being which comes to us through our scriptures. You read the Vedanta, you read the Gita, then they will tell you, who is this inner person? How does he look? Is he Angushta Matre or is he has got the brilliance of a thousand sun? Somebody who has seen tells you how this inner being is there. Once you know mentally, next is to feel. That's the brilliant thing. All of us, we stop at that knowing. Ha, ami jani, ami porechi, Gita porechi, Upanishad porechi, ami jani, who is Brahman, who is Atman. But have you felt him ever? Have you really connected him within? We have to feel, second stage, third stage. Next, to be that. You see, now you are so much, you know, in a love affair, what happens? Once you know each other, once you belong to each other, you want to get married. You want to get the identification on the physical level. And then the identity begins to grow higher. But why do you want to get married? Because you want to be united on a certain level. So this is that becoming with the divine also, that you want to be that. So that identity begins. That communion and the communication with the divine begins. And then to enter into contact with the greater reality beyond. And this identity is there and it's no more the love affair of SMS. Now I want to be in a continuous contact and communication. Because I know not only is he there beyond, but he's there within. He's pervading. And which inhabits also our own being. To be in communion with it and union with it, and a turning, a conversion, a transformation of our whole being as a result of the aspiration, the contact, the union, a growth or waking into a new becoming or new being, a new self, a new nature. Ultimately, once you have known him, seen him, identified with him, united with him, now what is it? You want to have what the Gita said, Sadrishya Mukti, Salokya Mukti. You see, now I want to be like the divine. I want to change my nature. What the Gita tells us in the toward the end, Manmana Bhakta Madhyaji Mam Namaskuru. Become my minded, my devotee, my worker. So we want to get the nature of the divine. And that is what Sri Aurobindo's yoga is. The transformation. The old yogas have given you unity, identity with Brahman. But they said, that's it. But Sri Aurobindo says, no. After that, you must be able to live in that world, have the nature of the divine. And in one word, you also want to become God-like and God himself. And man can become God. In fact, in the life divine, you would say, man is God in the making, and that Superman is the God where man has become God. So this is the true spiritual description, and that is what Sri Aurobindo is really asking us, that is the age we are moving towards. And this is the outer evolution, but an outer evolution also converging with the spiritual. And it is in this convergence I found an answer to my own question about your management, your economics, your outer science and technology. What is the stage of management now? We see a tremendous sea change in the management philosophy. What has it become? Suddenly management looks into the individual importance of the individual. Till yesterday it was the importance of the machine, the methodologies, the matter, how much profit you are getting. But today every management across the world, from Japan to America to Europe to India, we are beginning to see man is important. The individual is important. And what has spirituality told us today? Sri Aurobindo tells us the same thing, that it is the individual who is important. Tomorrow spirituality means it's the individual who becomes important. But the only difference is, today the outer world thinks the individual means my personality, my degrees, myself, my democracy, my rights. But nevertheless, it is an emphasis on the individual. And that management and science and technology have contributed to the spiritual march. Because spirituality is the emphasis on the true individual, as we have seen in the description, the inner individual. So science, in spite of itself, with all the upheavals of economics downfall or the what you call the meltdown of the economics, what's happening now, all this is moving towards that spiritual age. No doubt about it. Because in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, nothing in human march is waste. We may have to go through some troublesome periods, crashing periods, but mankind will come out victorious. There's no other future for mankind except to become divinized. It's a matter of the length of time. Today, tomorrow, 100 years, 500 years, it's a matter of the process of time. But the end of this evolution, the inner and the outer, is marked out. Outwardly we go towards a spiritual age, inwardly the psychic being will go towards a spiritual age, wherein it will manifest itself. And therefore, I think when Sri Aurobindo left his body, and the mother standing by, she requested him to come back to his body, and Sri Aurobindo said, no, I will not come back, I have left it purposely. Now I will come back as the first supramentalized manner, a person in the supramental manner. So that will be the beginning of the new supramental race. So you can see, I mean, when we see this immense universal picture what Sri Aurobindo gives us, then the present we can understand. All the violence, all the torture, all the bombs that are going around, we get some kind of an understanding. And as it was said, it brings us, Sri Aurobindo brings us, the peace of understanding. Thanks a lot.